Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The protests persist. Peaceful demonstrations continue nationwide as a divide emerges among police over how to handle them. Some showing solidarity with protesters, others showing force. Then, signs of an economic recovery. A better-than-expected jobs report shows a surprising rebound in the labor market, but millions remain out of work. And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks examined this week of massive protests and President Trump's reaction by calling up the nation's military. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The United States enters this first weekend in June still reeling with outrage over the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. But there is also news of economic recovery, with more than 2 million jobs added back to the workforce last month. The president melded the two today and quickly drew criticism for it. Stephanie Tsai begins our coverage.
Hopefully George is looking down right now and saying, this is a great thing that's happening for our country. This is a great day for him. It's a great day for everybody.
President Trump invoked the memory of George Floyd this morning as he hailed the May jobs report, calling it the greatest thing that can happen for race relations, even though unemployment rates for minorities actually went up. In Delaware, a short time later, the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, former Vice President Joe Biden, condemned Mr. Trump's remarks.
For the president to try to put any other words in the mouths of George Floyd, I frankly think is despicable.
The president's appearance came in the Rose Garden at a White House now behind barricades, but he only briefly addressed the nationwide protests against police violence on Black Americans.
It'll all work out. Some governors may need a little help yet, but I think for the most part, they're in good shape. We have fantastic military. We have fantastic National Guard. National Guard was barely used. You have to dominate the streets. You can't let what's happening happen.
But on one street near the White House, the protesters' cause now dominates. After a week defined by unrest and crackdowns from the police and National Guard, today, a major street declared Black Lives Matter in bright yellow paint. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser officially renamed the block Black Lives Matter Plaza.
What we have to say to the young Black youth is that they matter, we care about them, and we hear them, and we're listening to them, and we're trying to make all of our systems, starting right here in Washington, D.C., more fair.
But the local Black Lives Matter chapter called the action, quote, a performative distraction from real policy, and instead demanded tangible reforms.
Hands up! Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Last night, peaceful demonstrators weathered D.C. thunderstorms at the 8-foot fence now circling the perimeter of the People's House. It was one of many protests around the country free of violence. But in Buffalo, New York, another viral video of police violence. Local news cameras captured the moment an officer pushed 75-year-old Martin Gugino to the ground, leaving blood dripping from a head wound. The officers had claimed the man tripped. They have since been suspended. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said he was alarmed.
It disturbs your basic sense of decency and humanity. Why? Why? Why was that necessary? Where was the threat? Older gentleman, where was the threat?
It was one of a growing number of incidents of police violence being reported, including Tuesday in Los Angeles, where police smashed a Black man's car windows and dragged him onto the ground. In New York City, last night, police were more restrained than the night before, but eventually they did arrest demonstrators for breaking the 8 o'clock curfew. Mayor Bill de Blasio defended the enforcement actions.
Sometimes it's because there's a lot more there than meets the eye. And when you're after curfew, you have a threat of violence, you have evidence of violence being intended, and people have been asked to disperse. I want to remind you that those are real conditions that have to be understood.
Meanwhile, the National Football League is under increasing pressure. 4 years after the San Francisco 49ers' Colin Kaepernick started his own protest by taking a knee during the national anthem. He has not played in the league since. In Florida today, the Jacksonville Jaguars marched in solidarity.
What if I was George Floyd?
And more than a dozen NFL players released a Stronger Together video on social media.
On behalf of the National Football League,
this is what we, the players,
would like to hear you state.
We, the National Football League,
condemn racism and the systematic oppression of black people.
Those demands continue today and into this evening in cities across the country, from Kansas City.
This is people against racism and injustice.
To Dallas, where the police department organized a Blue for Black Lives Matter march. And in Minneapolis today, where police killed George Floyd, the city agreed to ban all police chokeholds and require any bystanding officers to intervene in violations. And California Governor Gavin Newsom also announced an end to pinning suspects by the neck. Support from unexpected corners and steps toward reform. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
In the day's other news, talk of a turnaround from the pandemic accelerated on news of those surprising job gains in the month of May. The economy added 2.5 million jobs after losing 21 million in March and April. And the national unemployment rate fell more than a full point to 13.3%. We'll get the details after the news summary. The jobs report sent a jolt of optimism through Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 829 points, or 3%, to close above 27,100. The Nasdaq rose 198 points, and the S&P 500 added 81. Even as economic activity picks up, the COVID-19 pandemic continues to take a toll globally and in the U.S. Worldwide deaths neared 400,000 today, with more than a quarter of those in the United States. In Geneva, the World Health Organization called for widespread use of face masks by more than just health workers and patients.
In light of evolving evidence, WHO advises that governments should encourage the general public to wear masks where there is widespread transmission and physical distancing is difficult, such as on public transport, in shops, or in other confined or crowded environments.
The issue of social distancing also came up at President Trump's White House event today. Staffers moved reporters' chairs closer together than the recommended 6 feet. They said they did it because, quote, it looks better. The commanding general of U.S. forces in Japan said that China's Navy is moving aggressively across the South China Sea while the pandemic occupies the world's attention. He says the goal is to push Beijing's sweeping territorial claims and intimidate other nations with their own claims. The South China Sea has rich energy reserves. And in the U.S. presidential campaign, an Associated Press count shows former Vice President Joe Biden is now within just 18 delegates of clinching the Democratic nomination. He could win those in primaries over the next few days. Meanwhile, Twitter has disabled a Trump campaign video honoring George Floyd. The social media company cited a copyright complaint. Still to come on the NewsHour, a new jobs report shows a surprising recovery in the labor market. We discuss the ongoing nationwide protest with the mayor of Los Angeles. Mark Shields and David Brooks break down this moment in America, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The unexpectedly strong jobs numbers caught most economists by surprise. But as John Yang reports, the Trump administration was quick to hail them as early indications that an economic recovery is already underway.
Judy, this afternoon in Maine, the president said that today's jobs report was a sign that good times are ahead.
America's economic comeback has begun. The next year is set to be a year, and you gotta remember I said it, but it's going to be an amazing year. Very big thing happened, though, today when we saw numbers the likes of which we've never seen in the history of our country. Good timing, because people look at that and they say, hey, this country's great. We've done things that nobody else has ever done.
But how do others see the numbers in that report, and how much do they tell us about the future? Elise Gould is a labor economist at the Economic Policy Institute, a research center here in Washington that gets funding from organized labor. And Lisa Desjardins covers economic policy on Capitol Hill for us at the NewsHour. Elise, let me start with you. You heard the president say that looking at this jobs report, America's economic comeback has begun. Do you see that in this report?
Not yet. It certainly is a welcome surprise that the top line payroll numbers did start to turn around, but it would be a mistake to think it is now time for policymakers to turn off the valve and to stop providing aid to workers, their families, aid, necessary aid to state and local governments. We still have a long way to go.
What does, I mean, the consensus of economists was that we would see another drop in payroll in jobs. How do you explain, or when you look at the numbers, what does it tell you to explain this increase of 2.5 million?
It is a bit of a puzzle. Absolutely, many economists did not expect this. I think there's a couple of factors. One is that initial unemployment insurance claims came in around 10 million between the reference period in April and the reference period in May. That led many people to think that the job losses would still be large. As it turns out, it seems that maybe some of the hires have offset that, and maybe some of those claims were actually pent-up demand when people couldn't get in earlier to make those claims. It's also possible the Paycheck Protection Program has actually gotten people back on payrolls as well.
Where are those new jobs? Where do they come from in May?
So in May, we saw many of the sectors that had the first big job losses. Some of those have come back. Again, 31 states have begun easing their stay-at-home restrictions, so I think we can see that as a result there. That's leisure and hospitality, retail trade, saw some gains in healthcare employment, even in construction.
Earlier today, President Trump said, was asked about what he could do to help race relations in America, and he said a strong economy was his answer, and he pointed to these jobs numbers. But even in these jobs numbers, we see the continuing disparity along racial lines. And even in this little mini rebound in May, we see disparity along racial lines.
Yes, that's exactly right. Well, we know that there were job losses across the board, devastating job losses, right, that we saw in March and April. And those are felt by families across the economy differently. The job losses that hit Black workers are actually more devastating because they have historically higher unemployment rates, higher poverty rates, lower income, lower wages, and lowered liquid savings to be able to weather that kind of a storm of those massive job losses. And then in May, you see this bright light, little sign, a glimmer of some hope, but it's actually hitting white workers, not hitting Black workers. So it's adding more insult to injury, and it seems that this recovery, as it has just begun, has already started to discriminate further against those Black workers.
Lisa Desjardins, President Trump this morning in the Rose Garden signed an extension of one of the efforts that Congress is making to try to help people, the Payroll Protection Program that Elise just mentioned. There is anecdotal evidence that you have that this is helping. Is that right? And also, what's in this extension that the president signed?
This is something critical for many of these millions of these small businesses, John, who have been waiting for weeks, worried they were not going to be able to use this money. This, of course, is the program that is meant to help businesses with 500 or fewer workers. The idea is this program essentially floats most of the fixed costs for those businesses for 2 months. That's how much money the federal government is giving. However, those businesses were only given an 8-week window to use that money. So that was a problem for a lot of them. So let's look at a graphic about what has changed, what the president signed today. First of all, the bill from the Congress and president said these funds can be spent over 24 weeks. It was 8 weeks, so that's a huge extension. Now, 60% of that money must go to salaries. That's a lower figure than previously. It was 75%. Some of these businesses said, we don't spend 75% on our salaries. 60% is too much. So essentially, John, what's happened here is businesses aren't getting more money, but they're getting a lot more flexibility. There are some technical problems with the way this bill was written. However, we're seeing what changes may come when this is actually administered. But as far as evidence that this bill, that this program made a big deal in our economy, this was clearly the largest infusion of cash in the economy in the past months. Let's look a little bit at what this program did. Another graphic here for you. We've got a program that so far has used $510 billion. It still has more than $100 billion left to spend that's been approved. Now, this is 4.5 million American small businesses that have used this fund. And John, the average loan is not that large considering the situation right now, about $114,000 on average. So we are talking about small businesses across this country. And if you look at the data, if you look at exactly when this money hit, most of these businesses got this money in May, and that could have something to do with these unemployment numbers.
Lisa, what do you think these unemployment numbers will do to the thinking on Capitol Hill about another or more stimulus down the line?
Speaking with sources across the Capitol and in both parties, I'll tell you, Republicans feel that this bolsters their argument that it is time to take a pause and to wait before there is more money spent, more relief given. They want to see what the relief so far has done. Now, House Democrats, Speaker Pelosi sent out a statement today saying she thinks the opposite, that this money spent shows that it was spent well, that the unemployment results are from previous relief. And if they stop spending the money, she is saying, she thinks unemployment will go back up. I have to tell you, John, I think overall the Republicans seem to be winning the momentum contest here. And there is a very large debate. Unemployment benefits also were extended under the CARES Act because of the pandemic. And Democrats would like to keep that going. It's $600 more for unemployment than previously. And they would like to keep that going. But that runs out at the end of July. And they admit to me, John, that these unemployment numbers are going to make it harder for them to get that extension.
Elise Gould, when they were doing the CARES Act on Capitol Hill and talking about the unemployment benefits, there was an argument made by some Republicans that it was a disincentive to employment by raising the unemployment benefits and also extending them. What, as a labor economist, what's your reaction to that?
Well, the $600, it is, my argument would be that it is very important to extend that. That does run out in July. That has been vital to keep workers afloat during this time. It has allowed workers who live in states that have very low replacement rates to try to continue to make ends meet, to continue to put food on their tables, put a roof over their heads. And without that money, they are going to be absolutely economically devastated. I think it speaks more to the fact that wages are so low for many workers across this country that $600 could actually make that much of a difference. So it is vital to keep that turned on. And when workers get called back to work, they can't keep collecting that $600. They're going to have to go back to work. So as a disincentive to work, I don't really see that happening there.
With thunder rolling in the background here in Washington, D.C., Elise Gould of the Economic Policy Institute, Lisa Desjardins, our congressional correspondent for the NewsHour. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you.
The nationwide protests over the killing of George Floyd are forcing many state and local government officials to closely re-examine their law enforcement agencies. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti announced yesterday his proposal to cut $150 million from the city's police budget and to put that money toward helping communities of color. And Mayor Garcetti joins us now. Welcome back to the NewsHour. Mr. Mayor, so I think a lot of people can understand why you would want to put this money into communities that are hurting, but why take it from the police department, and particularly just a few weeks after you were calling for an increase in the police department budget?
It's a fair question to ask, Judy, and good to be with you again. Look, budgets are moral documents, and we knew in COVID-19 that we would have to make cuts almost everywhere. Myself, our civilian departments took a 10% cut. So I want to be very clear with my police officers and anybody else listening. This is shared sacrifice, but no one department can be completely immune. We have to, in tough economic times and in a moment of racial justice where we have the opportunity. Any police officer out there I've ever talked to said, please, can you invest in education and in healthcare and the things that might prevent crime before I have to deal with it? we give them so much to shoulder on their backs that they're supposed to solve homelessness and mental health, deal with the lack of education in communities of color. Let's, in a very difficult moment, start going down a road where we say that those things too are priorities. It's not an either or, it's a yes and. We've all squeezed our budgets. It's something that in our largest department we can do and still keep our police officers well protected, invested in their training, making sure that they're compensated in the right way. But if we don't start walking through this door today, when will we? And if we don't take this action, who will? So I hear what people are saying out there, as well as what my officers say too. We have to find a better way. It can't just be on the back of policing. It has to be in the reflections of a society that says, long before a criminal justice system intervenes, we can do things to give people the lives that they deserve and not have the racial disparities that for so long we have had in America.
But you're acknowledging the impetus for this, the turnaround, was because of the killing of George Floyd.
It certainly should be an accelerant for all of us, but no, it's not when it started. I, as mayor, for instance, over the last 7 years, the largest thing that's increased has been our investments in housing and to house people who are experiencing homelessness, about $700 million that we didn't have before. When we look at the growth of our budget, we've increased our gang reduction youth development workers, people who've been criminally justice involved who now work as mentors, keep our parks open late. That's increased 50%, while the number of police officers we've had has stayed the same. Do budgets go up? All budgets do because of more receipts and the cost of living. But we've put our priority overwhelmingly long before today in trying to invest in those things that can help our officers be safer and help our communities be safer. You don't have to choose between those two. And I know that's a tough message. People right now are listening with the ears that either characterize all police officers as terrible human beings or vice versa, that have for too long characterized people of color, especially African-American men and women, as threats. We can't stand for either of those things. And the second results in the loss of life based on your skin. And the other one puts police officers in danger. We have to move forward in the momentum that built long before today, but certainly that today demands an acceleration of, and I'm proud LA is taking those steps.
Well, we should just point out, though, that the Black Lives Matter group and others are saying these cuts aren't nearly enough in the police department. They're saying there should be a 90% cut below what the city was already spending there in Los Angeles. They want to cut the number of police. In fact, some are saying get rid of the department altogether, virtually. Saying this is as far as you're going to go.
No, there's always more, and as we have a stronger economy, let's continue investing in those things. How do we have so many people without health care? How is it that you can live 12 years less if you're growing up in Watts than Bel Air here? That women who are Black have a 4 to 6 times a higher rate of dying in childbirth? That's something we can all embrace together. But I want to be very clear, too, that this is something in which folks who would say, let's get rid of our police departments, I respectfully disagree with. I've seen police officers intervene to break up sex trafficking rings, to make sure that a woman experiencing domestic violence has safety, who have mentored young people. We have to change models and cultures, but not get rid of the idea of having peace officers. I want to have heroes all over our communities and investments in our young people. And the idea that we have to choose between those two is the wrong dichotomy.
In that connection, you said just in the last few days, and I'm quoting, the vast majority do this job selflessly and with the honor and dignity befitting the badge. But we know, Mayor Garcetti, in the last few days, there have been a number of incidents involving Los Angeles police and these protesters. We have some video to show. In fact, some we showed earlier in the news hour. These are scenes that have played out on social media. One of them, in one case, there was the police used a baton on someone who was standing there peacefully. In other cases, a police car drove into people in the street. There was another instance where officers smashed the windows of a car that was sitting there, dragged the person out of the car. How does all this square with your description of police officers, most of whom you say are acting with the dignity that befits the badge?
Yeah, we have hundreds of thousands of incidents that happen in any given year, and even in this toughest times, and there should be accountability always. We have an independent inspector general, a police commission made up of citizens, not the police officers, who investigate these, and those should be investigated and should trouble us. Although I always caution people, one angle, one camera thing may tell not the entire story. For instance, the car that was backing away was taking projectiles, and we had seen an officer get a cracked skull and nearly die. That said, I know that policing is an extremely tough job, but protesters should be protected. We should always have accountability. And I hope that we lift up the stories of the amazing moments we saw where folks had dialogue, where they hugged, where they took knees, where they engaged, as well as holding anything that violates policy in our city and holding those individuals accountable.
But are these incidents and any others, any other questionable incidents like them, are they all being investigated?
Yes, 100%, and our inspector general is available for anybody else who has ones that need investigation. It's something that is not new now. I know a lot of people may be having these interactions for the first time in their life. That is something that we set up not only years ago, but decades ago in our police department here. And that accountability has to be for anybody, whether they're a government employee, a member of the public, and no badge should hide that, no title should hide that, as well as for the public as well.
Mayor Garcetti, I'm sure you know that a number of the folks who are involved in the protest, though, are saying investigating isn't good enough. They're calling on the police chief, your police chief, Michael Moore, to step down, to be fired. Some of them I even heard today on the steps of City Hall calling for you to step down. How do you answer this?
Well, that's part of being a leader. I don't think I've been in office a day when somebody either from this direction or that direction doesn't want me to step down. But I think we're called to these moments, to define with action and not with words what we do. I'm very proud of the things we've done in this city, whether it's together raising a minimum wage, making college free, making sure that we can have a system that invests in young people who are most at risk in our communities. This is a moment where we either will meet the moment or we'll miss the moment. I don't intend to miss the moment. I know that this is excruciatingly difficult work. It's excruciatingly difficult to be a protester calling for justice through the rage, to be a police officer exercising restraint, and to be a guardian on the line. To be a police chief right now, there is nothing you can do right, but I do believe there are actions we can take that in the face of criticism, 20 years from now, when we look back, say, changed the paradigm, opened the door, built a more just society. These are the birth pangs of finally birthing a true racial, multiracial democracy in America. And there are things you can do. If you're a mayor out there, do the eight things that will reduce police killings by 72% statistically. We have done all eight, and we've pledged to do a number more. Help police officers have the mental health care. Compensate them well enough to make sure you're getting the people that you want. Demand that there's accountability. And engage in not just the criminal justice system, but so much more, because structural racism lives in the heart of so many people in America. We have to own that. And we have to say, too, that it manifests not just in the criminal justice system. We have to say that it manifests in our healthcare system, our jobs and economy, in our education. And it is time for us finally to seize this moment to make sure George Floyd didn't die in vain, that Breonna Taylor, whose birthday is today, that we learn the lessons that people should not die because of the color of their skin, and that we must find the common humanity between us all, whether it's a police officer and somebody who pays their salary, whether it's a young person of a different color, or whether it's people who live in different parts of this country. It is time for us to finally heal America.
And just in a word, you are standing by your police chief right now.
Oh, our police chief made one comment that I said if it was in his heart, he would no longer be police chief. He corrected himself within seconds, but I know that often doesn't make the second part of the news. There is no moral equivalent of looting and murder. He knows that. I know that. He is a reformer who came in after the Rampart scandal as the captain to clean up Rampart, did a tremendous job, and we all are called to leave. We don't have time right now to late night comments that are made when you're tired. If you have that in your heart, you're not working for me. I know that's not his heart.
Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, we thank you very much.
As always, strength and love to you.
To help us make sense of a week that brought protesters into the streets in more than 700 American cities and towns, the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. So hello to both of you. What about these protesters, Mark? I've just been talking with Mayor Garcetti of Los Angeles about it, but as we said, 700 cities and towns across the country, thousands and thousands of people in the streets,
It started out about George Floyd. It's become, I think it's fair to say, something much bigger than that. What do you make of it?
Judy, it's quite unlike anything I've ever seen. Most protests here in Washington involve the usual suspects on both sides. Those are committed partisans, in some cases zealots, who show up regularly. This is remarkable in its composition. It's people who are not protesters, who are not political activists. At the same time, even though it's spawned by, inspired by the tragic death of George Floyd, it is not specifically racial. There's a very large white composition in it. That to me is rather remarkable. The reach of it, it's reached not only the major cities, but small towns worldwide. I think this is of enormous significance. So it can't be a little consolation to George Floyd's family and loved ones, but his death is having an enormous impact on this country, and it will not be just transitory. I think it'll be permanent.
You think it'll be, David? Do you think this is a different moment? We've seen moments of protest. We've seen police involve killings of black men. What's different this time?
I would say it's a combination of things. I sort of think of it as an hurricane that's happening in an earthquake. The earthquake started in 2014 with Ferguson, with a lot of terrorist killings, then the election of Donald Trump. And we saw ravines open up in our society. We saw divides in politics. We saw racial divides, economic divides, obviously. And into this comes first a pandemic, just pouring water and exposing all the divides. And then this killing, this murder, which exposes them more. And then you get this generational turnover. You've had a generation of people under 35 who've seen the financial crisis, who've seen a bit of the war on the Iraq maybe, but who've seen nothing on global warming. And so this is a generation that is fed up. And frankly, a lot of people in the African-American community are fed up. The word I keep hearing is exhausted. And so I do think when you calculate the depth of the ravines that are being exposed with a generational change, with a sense of America finally turning to race as maybe the central storyline in our history or our story right now. These are just big epic shifts. And I do think it's like one of those big shifts that happened periodically in American history, 68 or 1890 or 1830. I think we're in the middle of something. I agree with Mark. I think it's not just a moment. It's a climactic shift.
Mark, a shift, will it lead to something distinctly different, though, from what we have today? Because these protesters, as we've just been discussing, they want police departments defunded, or they want budgets cut. They want real change. They want more African Americans elected to office, and many, many other demands around education, around housing, around communities. Are those things really going to change?
Well, Judy, I mean, I think there's demands and there's demands. I mean, I think that Mayor Garcetti made a good point that both the African-American community and the police need each other. They truly do. I mean, African-Americans disproportionately live in high crime areas, and they do want an engaged, principled and activist police force working to preserve peace and order in their community. But I think we're far beyond the prayers and thoughts, reaction. I think there's an awakening in this country to the fact that African Americans, people of color, have been treated, and it's irrefutable, have been treated differently in law enforcement and unfairly. I don't think there's any question about that. I do find it encouraging that two institutions that have been sort of sidelined, it seems, in our country, that were so much involved in the American Civil Rights Movement, and were played principal roles this week. I mean, I thought Bishop Buddy of the Episcopal Church here in Washington spoke up so forcefully about the photo op at St. using and abusing her church. Archbishop Wilton Gregory, the African-American Catholic Archbishop of of Washington, D.C., spoke out strenuously, emphatically against using religious places and symbols to exploit political advantage, especially when the message is not one of inclusiveness or justice. So, and the United States military, I mean, it's no accident that the United States military, the most integrated institution in our society, that the words of people like General Martin Dempsey and Admiral Mike McMullen, Mike Hayden, and Stanley McChrystal, and Admiral McRaven, as well as, of course, General Mattis, and the reaction of the military, I think, was encouraging. So I'm hopeful.
David, I do want to ask you both about the president and the use of the military, but just quickly, do you think there'll be real change coming out of what we're seeing?
Yeah, I look at the polls, and we never used to get polls where it was above 55% for anything. We were a completely and evenly divided country. And now we had a poll, PBS Marist poll, 67% disapproving way Donald Trump is reacting to this moment, 67% reaction to the lockdown. We had 77%. Again and again over the course of the last 3 months, we've had polls in the 60s and 70s. It looks to me like we're a less divided country when they were. Joe Biden opening up now an 8-point lead on the average of polls. So, I mean, this dumb thing to say is we're moving left. And the pandemic and this event have just underlined the inequalities in America. And whether you like it or not, I just think that's the reality if you look at the evidence.
And David, let me turn you to what Mark brought up, and that is the president invoking the military. I mean, having the military armed people out in the streets, troops clearing the streets forcefully to make way so that he could walk across the area, the Lafayette Square, to hold a Bible in front of St. John's Church. A lot of pushback, as Mark reminded us, from former military officials. We're even seeing current military leaders pull back. Is this a moment of turn for this president, do you think?
I do. I mentioned the polling, but listen, he's been a bully for a long time, but he was a bully over Twitter. And maybe he was a bully to the press. But now he's using U.S. troops to be a bully. I think what set General Mattis off was just watching the military, which is a fine, unprofessional, and professional but unpoliticized organization, suddenly turn into a prop in a campaign video. And I think that turned his stomach as it should turn all our stomachs. But I think what mystifies me, and it goes back to what you were talking about with Mayor Garcetti, is you have a president who's taken this authoritarian line of domination, be dominant, unleash vicious dogs and dangerous weapons. And that's not only just talk anymore. And it swings through the Republican Party and Senator Tom Cotton's tweets about, you know, no quarter given. We're going to dominate our fellow citizens as if they're enemy. And then I think it bleeds down into the police and the videos we've already seen tonight. It's a theme that is coming from the top, from the White House, a theme of brutalism, of mental brutalism, and it affects people. And what we've seen coming out of the White House has been a more dangerous contagion than even with all the outrages of the past.
Mark, David raised it's the term, and the president used it again today. We need to dominate, he said, even as they are now announcing they're going to pull uniformed military out of the streets of Washington. But, I mean, the orders are there. I mean, we know what happened this week. We know that the president talked about calling out the National Guard. He urged governors to use the National Guard. He said they were weak, would look like fools if they didn't. And we're left with the reminders of this.
This is the world of Donald Trump. To be very blunt about it, Admiral Mattis may have put it best at the Al Smith dinner in New York last fall, which I'm sure didn't escape the president's attention, when he said, I earn my spurs. I, General Mattis, earned my spurs in battle. And Donald Trump earned his spurs in a doctor's letter. And that's the toughness. That's sort of the phony toughness of Donald Trump. The swagger when his number came up and his chance came up to serve and to get tough. He of course ran and scurried personally, but he is somebody who loves to bully other people, and he does not. I guess what bothers me more than anything else. I saw him today in an act at Jack Reed, the senator from Rhode Island. Very respected member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, is called petty and preposterous, pulling 9,500 American troops out of Germany why? Out of spite and out of pettiness, because Mrs. Merkel declined his invitation to be part of the photo op of the G7 at Camp David next month, on the very legitimate grounds of coronavirus. So, I mean, this is the president. He does not understand the military. It's kind of a crazy swagger John Wayne movie version of it. Most military people, I just miss John McCain so much. If John McCain were alive today, it would be scorching and scalding the rhetoric he would be directing at this president of his own party.
And David, as we wrap up our conversation, what hope can we take into the weekend?
Well, listen, these rallies, most of the cops have been great. They've been fine. They've been dancing with people. They've been kneeling with people. They've been talking to people. You know, we cover the extremes, and that's, you know, what we do. It's where the conflict is, and maybe it's where the cutting edge of history is. But most of the protests, we've all seen them. They've been calm and peaceful. They've been dedicated to policy. They've been dedicated to fundamental change. And they've been warm, and even amidst the anger, there's comradeship there. And most of the cops have done their job. And so we shouldn't take the extremes for what is going on in the middle, which is pretty damn good.
On that note, David Brooks, Mark Shields, thank you. And to all of you, please join us tonight. Race Matters, America in Crisis. It is a PBS NewsHour primetime special. We'll hear from powerful voices on inequality, policing, and the African-American experience. Tune in at 9 o'clock Eastern on your local PBS station or online at pbs.org/newshour. And we'll be back shortly with our weekly look back at some of the remarkable lives lost to COVID-19. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air. Now, special correspondent Charlaine Hunter-Galt visits a law enforcement agency making amends for its violent past in this encore presentation of a Race Matters report. I woke up this
morning with my mind. During the 50th anniversary of police violence against peaceful civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama, that ended in Montgomery, Police Chief Kevin Murphy did something surprising. He apologized to Congressman John Lewis, a frequent victim of that earlier violence, and handed him his badge. We caught up with Murphy where he now works as Montgomery County Deputy Sheriff and where some of his solutions are still in place.
Kevin Murphy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What moved you to hand John Lewis your badge that day?
Well, as a young officer, I had seen Congressman Lewis and the congressional delegation, Faith and Politics, come to Montgomery over a several-year period. They would follow the civil rights trail, and they would come and spend time in Montgomery. And as a young member of the department, I would see him and wonder, why hasn't anyone ever acknowledged, you know, the injustices that occurred here? And thought, if I ever become police chief, I'm going to change that. And then the day did arrive when they were to come to Montgomery for their annual tour. And I did not tell anybody. I did not want it to be a political act. I wanted it to be sincere and heartfelt. And the respect that I have for Congressman Lewis is immeasurable.
Well, he's told me he has the same for you. In your early days as a police officer, you asked questions. What kind of questions did you ask, and what kind of responses did you get?
I found that a lot of the officers who had really lived through that era, particularly the white officers, were very reluctant and uncomfortable with talking about it.
So when you became chief, what steps did you take to change what you saw as the wrongs?
One of the first things that I implemented as the new police chief was enacting a class, creating a class. And we went way back in history to the Dred Scott decision, all the way through to the Emmett Till case, because I wanted the officers to experience what really happened. You know, what my observation was, you have a 21-year-old officer who had never lived through or seen the civil rights era for what it was, the dark reality of it. And so this young officer would stop an African-American citizen and get somewhat of a pushback, because maybe this 60 or 75-year-old African-American citizen's last encounter with a Montgomery police officer was very negative. After they attended the class, I saw a lot of promise in that the next time they encountered that citizen, they felt like, I understand now.
And you put this class, you got this class put into the police academy's training.
I did. And we actually had all members of the department, not just the sworn officers, but the civilians attended as well and had tremendous feedback. The first part of the course is classroom, then a tour of the Rosa Parks Museum. But my favorite part of the class was the conclusion, where there was a values segment. And the values segment was giving scenarios to the members of the class. You know, it was strongly agree, somewhat agree, strongly disagree, somewhat disagree. But I was proud of the answers and the outcomes of those scenarios, because they were learning from the class that, you know, you have to be very careful in the way that you apply this power. And, you know, we're seeing it in the country now. And I think that we were teaching that in this class, how to de-escalate a situation where a citizen was upset because they thought that they were going to be mistreated when they saw the patch of the Montgomery Police Department. And it was the officer's responsibility to ensure that citizen that that was not going to occur.
What do you think in that experience is replicable or has any kind of application today?
I think law enforcement needs to get to work. And I think that one of the biggest challenges that we face in this new century is our response to what I would call a critical event, where you have a citizen who's become violent, citizen who's under the influence of drugs, or perhaps they're suffering from some type of mental health issue. And what I've seen with a lot of these encounters that end very badly, with the death of an unarmed citizen, is a fear on the part of the officer. And we all experience it in this uniform. It's nothing to be ashamed of, but you have to be able to manage that fear. And I believe sometimes when fear steps in, poor decisions are made. And I think that the use of deadly force falls into that category.
So what do you do about it?
We need to be able to teach the officers, the deputies coming into this profession, how to manage your fear. No one ever did that to us, my generation.
What do you think is the most important thing to do now to ensure that everybody, the police, are respected as well as those who deserve to be protected by the police and even those who commit crimes?
Law enforcement needs to start holding themselves accountable. And you're starting to see it in some parts of the country where officers are being held accountable and there are consequences for bad behavior.
A lot of the people who have been victims of improper police behavior were innocent. But what do you do when you got criminals? I mean, not everybody's innocent.
It's not a police officer's job to punish. We're there to enforce the law and to take people into custody. But I think you have seen in some instances, and certainly back in the early in the latter parts of the last century, that, you know, law enforcement felt like it was their role to punish. And, you know, it's our responsibility to apprehend and bring these people before the courts. You know, there's no such thing as street justice. You have to abide by the law when you're wearing a uniform and set the example. When you don't do that, you've lost all credibility with the public that you serve.
Well, Kevin Murphy, thank you.
Thank you.
Amid days of unrest and mass protests across the country, we don't want to forget that the novel coronavirus continues to take the lives of individuals every day. Here are the stories of just some of those who've fallen victim to this virus. Hatsi Yasukochi was the heart of her family-run bakery in San Francisco. She knew her customers by name and often their orders by heart. A proud mother and grandmother, Hatsi displayed family photos on the bakery walls and loved taking silly Snapchats with her five grandchildren. As a young girl, Hatsi's family was imprisoned in internment camps during the Second World War. Her daughters say that experience gave her the perseverance she would later rely on to battle cancer. She was 80 years old. Idris Bey worked to save lives and teach others as a 27-year veteran of the fire department in New York. Idris responded to the attacks on 9/11 as an emergency medical technician. He went on to instruct other first responders for nearly two decades. His longtime partner described Idris, or Mr. Bey as his students called him, as a dynamic teacher, relatable and funny, but also serious. The 60-year-old was also a father and a mentor, a humanitarian on and off the job. 78-year-old Mario Cesar Romero was a leader in his East Harlem community and a champion of Puerto Rican culture. Mario was raised in Manhattan, the son of immigrants. From childhood, he fell in love with the art and history of his parents' homeland. Through his work as an art historian, Harlem tour guide, and curator, he cultivated a love for art among his neighbors and his own family, especially his niece. Susan Rokas was a beloved elementary school teacher in Loudoun County, Virginia, for almost five decades. A woman of faith, friends say Susan was respectful and truthful, qualities she instilled in her young students. She was particularly skilled at helping children overcome challenges with reading through empathy and positivity. Susan also loved tea time with friends, tennis, and fashion. She was 73 years old. Luis Frias was a master of Argentine dance. Born in Buenos Aires, Luis began performing professionally at age 12. His passion and talent for malambo, a traditional dance once performed by cowboys, took him around the world. He traveled with the Ringling Brothers Circus and performed on the Las Vegas Strip and in Madison Square Garden. Offstage, his two daughters say he was a warm, funny, and compassionate grandfather and father. Luis was 65 years old. We remember them and we remember all those, and our hearts go out to the families of everyone we've lost. Once again, a reminder to please join us tonight for our special Race Matters, America in Crisis. It's a moment to listen. Tune in at 9 p.m. Eastern. And that's the NewsHour for this Friday night. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.